In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to... We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Rab, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film. For the purposes of this particular email, you may call me Rockmeister McCool. You needn't, but you may.
You don't have to call him that in an email. You can call him that in a handwritten letter. You can call him that in person, but only when the podcast is playing. This is our mail podcast. You write in. We answer your emails. We answer your letters. We answer your questions. We respond to your prompts. And, of course, we take criticism, because what kind of critics would we be if we couldn't take a little criticism? Whitney?
Yeah.
I know we actually had something in our P.O. box today.
We did.
And let's get started. If you write in and you take the effort to put it in like an envelope with a stamp or postcard, anything at all that ends up in our P.O. box, that will be read, and that will be read first, or at least whenever Whitney can actually get to it, because our post office kind of stinks and isn't open after hours.
Yeah, it just closes at 5. That's all
but,
it really
but
stinks
usually
about
the
it.
P.O.
And
boxes
they're understaffed,
are...
but that's not their
well,
fault.
Usually the P.O. boxes are accessible at a post office after hours, but for some reason ours has decided, fuck that.
Anyway, I'm crinkling the paper to let you
proof.
Know we have a letter
we
here.
We couldn't possibly be able to crinkle paper if we didn't have the letter in our hand.
But this is on a nice 3-ring binder, blue lined paper.
Classic.
The classic kind. This one comes from Shelby.
Hello.
And it says, gentlemen, Shelby from KY again, from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to keep my handwriting legible. I need to talk about Companion. You saw Companion.
I did
right?
see Companion.
Yeah,
yes,
I saw it too, yeah. With Jack Quaid. First, I'd love to hear Whitney's review and thoughts. Second, I want to agree with Bibbs on his review. First.
Okay.
I did get to see it. I watched it when it came to streaming. I missed it in theaters.
Mm.
But I did catch up with it. It's a fun concept. It's not robot-y enough. This idea of... the premise of Companion is it's about a young woman. She's very, very much in love with her boyfriend, played by Jack Quaid, and they're off on like a retreat with a few other couples, just in this like remote cabin, just so they can spend the weekend together. She's treated very poorly, but she tries to take everything in stride, and she is threatened by this creepy dude at this party. Like, she and this guy are, like, out by the pool together. And he kind of, like, comes onto her and tries to grope her. And then it tries to assault her. And she extracts a knife and stabs him in self-defense. And she walks back to the house, and she's kind of in a panic. And at that point, Jack Quaid says, oh, gosh, this shouldn't have happened. Go to sleep. And her eyes go white, and she passes out, and it turns out she's a robot. Mm-hmm. All of this was revealed in the previews.
Yeah, this is a near future where you can purchase a robot partner to your specs.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, she's Jack Quaid's purchase. Actually, she's a rental, which is kind of a plot point. But, he explains to her that she's a robot. This is something she's not really aware of. And she acted in self-defense, but robots aren't supposed to be able to hurt people.
And
this was like some kind of malfunction.
Yeah.
This is a fun premise for like a 30-minute Twilight Zone episode or a Tales from the Crypt episode, but they strain to push this thing into a feature film.
Mm.
And I feel like once they sort of give the big reveal... This idea that this woman is being treated as property because, as far as these men are concerned, she is. I feel like it doesn't go further to explore its themes than that. It just sort of repeats that point over and over again and tries to give her kind of a good for her narrative.
Yeah.
But I think it doesn't go far enough with that.
You're never satisfied, are you?
No. I always wanted it to be darker and more violent than it is.
I was happy the way it was, but fair enough.
There wasn't a lot of cleverness with the script. There wasn't a lot of clever things that she did.
Yeah, I thought there was some clever stuff in there. Mm. I thought there was some. I don't want to spoil it, but it wasn't that big a hit.
One of the conceits is that she's programmed to always tell the truth. So she finds ways around that, which I think that's one of the clever bits there. But yeah.
All right. Well, anyway.
Anyway, the letter continues. Third, I had to write this because of Letterboxd. I don't have a Letterboxd.
I do, but I've never used it. Like, I've used it like twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Letterboxd. It helps so much with cataloging movies, and I get to read others' reviews as well. But I keep seeing people either love or be mostly indifferent to this film. People who are giving it low reviews, seem to be looking at the movie from the wrong angle. Most of these people share the sentiment that this film says nothing new about AI or relationships. Those are more incidental to the plot than the plot, in my view.
Mm.
See, I see this as more of a new way to get away with murder movie, using this attached sex bot premise as the mechanism to make the story different and give them fun things to play with in the story.
Correct.
This movie, as Bib said, is a horror comedy. I don't believe it's trying to be a think piece or make commentary on AI. It's supposed to be fun and entertaining movie, which it succeeds at for me. If someone asked me to explain this movie, I'd say it's like, what if Ex Machina, but a 90s slasher comedy? And for a movie with as many twists as it encounters, it does come up with interesting wrap-ups in a nearly every scenario. Anyway, I don't like to argue with people about their Letterboxd reviews, so I had to talk to somebody and get your opinions and on my thoughts. Hope all is well. Hope life is improving in LA. Lastly, HBO's synopsis for the movie completely ruins the first few twists if you had missed the marketing. So boo to that. Love Sean.
Well, Whitney just did that too. Oh, well, but I do think that's one of those problems where it's got red eye syndrome, where in order to explain what the movie is, you have to spoil it because you treated the end of the first act like a big twist.
Yeah.
Like, I think the posters spoiled the movie. Mm. Like, it just flat out showed you that she was a robot.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, you're just tying the marketing department's hands behind their back, you know? They've only got so many options.
Mm.
So I'm sympathetic to that. I was fortunate enough that I was able to avoid the marketing and see it without any sort of preconceived notions.
Mm.
And I actually didn't quite guess exactly where it was going, so we totally go to sleep, and I was like, oh, that's clever. So I liked it a lot.
Maybe that was my issue. I wasn't startled by any of the twists.
Well, it had already been kind of spoiled for you, right? You already knew she was a robot.
You know, but some other things that happened later in the movie, I predicted those things.
Well, some
as
of those
well,
I predicted as well. Okay, listen. Mm. We're. I think the thing is that there's a temptation to treat every movie like it's supposed to be the best it could possibly be, and I've long started championing.
That's a reasonable.
I'm gonna make a slight counter.
Don't you shake your finger at me.
I'm doing it right now. I'm shaking it. No. I have long since argued in favor of the 4-star, 3-star movie.
Yeah,
which is a movie that, due to its premise or due to its ambitions or some inherent aspect of the production, was never going to be 4 stars. Was only like the best you could ever do was 3, but it hits 3. Like it's absolutely everything it needs to be. It was just never going to be more than that. And I think that's an okay thing to be. And I think Companion is skirting that. I think I see where people are coming from in that it touches upon bigger ideas and it isn't interested in exploring all of them to their utmost because, as you said, Shelby, at its core, this is a getting away with murder movie. This is a little Hitchcockian thriller with a sci-fi twist. So it doesn't have time for all of that. If it stopped to explore every single philosophical avenue, you would have something more like Ex Machina, which isn't necessarily a bad thing to be. But it's not what Companion was trying to be.
I'm not judging a film based on the film it could have been. I try to judge it on sort of the ideal version of itself. Like, what is it trying to do?
Well, you're deciding that, aren't you?
Well, I'm a critic. That's my job. I'm looking at a film and trying to determine what it was trying to do and then also determine how well it did that thing. Mm-hmm. Companion tried to be a sort of a wicked, getaway with murder, sci-fi, Hitchcockian thriller. with kind of a low budget. And I don't think it fully succeeded on those grounds.
Right. And you're not making the argument that it needed to be heady AI. That wasn't your argument. And I respect that because your argument was that it's trying to be a clever, twisty thriller and you didn't think it was all that clever, which is not the end of the world.
I didn't think it was all that clever or that twisty. That's my issue. My issue is that I don't think it fully succeeded in what it was clearly trying to achieve. A film can just sort of aim for the middle and hit it with a bullseye. Mm-hmm. And I love movies like that. One of my favorite films this year is Drop, which is a rather low budget, high concept thriller about a woman who is being stalked on her phone while she's on a blind date.
Yeah.
And she's instructed by these sinister text messages that she has to murder her date or somebody back at her house will kill her son.
Right.
And she can't say anything and she's being watched by cameras. What's she going to do?
Right. Little high concept B movie. Yeah.
Yeah. High concept B movie, but I think it nails it. I think it nails all of the thrills. I love all of the character work. It has clever dialogue. It has sets up and payoffs. It's just a really good version of that. Yeah. So I'm going to give that one a really high rating.
Yeah, that's how I felt about Fight or Flight, which is a story about Josh Hartnett fighting an army of hired killers on an airplane. Mm. That was never going to be profound.
Exactly.
That's the best they can do, really fun.
I like if a film is profound or it provokes me or makes me think, but I also understand that some films are aiming for cheap thrills, and if they give me really good cheap thrills, then I'm going to love it. Companion didn't give me the right kind of cheap thrills.
All right.
I feel like it did some illogical things that it didn't need to. The whole premise is that Jack Quaid has literally bought this character.
Yeah, don't ruin too much of it.
I'm not going to ruin too much, but if he sees this thing as an object, as a product that he's purchased, he still insistingly treats it like a person.
Okay, I think you're missing the point.
And I think that if we're trying to sort of highlight how misogynistic this character is, or at least how sexist he is, then he wouldn't be so compassionate to this thing that he's purchased.
I think you are overlooking the key character trait there, where he's also pathetic and insecure, and he needs validation even from his sex bot. I think that's part of it.
I don't quite buy it.
I bought that entirely. Anyway, listen.
I buy that he's pathetic. I just don't buy that angle of it.
I bought it fine.
They need him to behave that way so they can sort of perpetuate the story when really it should be about her and sort of her.
I mean, it is about her, but it's also about the villains. Mm. It's also one of those. Listen, we could go on about this, and I don't think we can. I think we've ruined enough of the movie, so let's let's move on. There's stuff we didn't talk about, though. There are other elements of that film that are revelations. Maybe you'll predict them. Maybe you won't. I had a really good time with that movie. It's not going to make my best of the year list or anything, but I had a really good time with that movie, and I do recommend it. All right.
So let's go to the emails. Let me look in here. Here's just a one that's just called Quick WGM Letter.
Okay.
It's from Nolan.
Hi, Nolan.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, before we start reading my email, I really think we ought to wait until Jonathan gets here. that's all the email says.
I just really think Jonathan would understand what we're getting at.
Yeah.
I think Jonathan would be on it. Okay.
Jonathan is, that's a gag from... I feel kind of an underrated film, Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which is, again, that's fluff. That's also a film that's not profound. It's kind of a special effects fantasy comedy film that I think has some very clever, genuinely funny bits in it.
Yeah.
In the way that you think every blockbuster ought to, but for some reason don't.
Yeah. No, I think Dungeons and Dragons. I think they're referencing a podcast from a few weeks ago where I went on and on about how
about Jonathan.
I just keep thinking about that line. I think Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves. It was a modest hit. It did okay. I think it's going to be one of those movies, kind of like Galaxy Quest, where for 10 years people are going to not talk about it a lot, but every time it does come up, everyone's going to be like, "I love that movie.
That's a great movie." Yeah, it was really fun.
And then finally, people are going to acknowledge that it is kind of a classic. I think it's only a matter of time.
It's going to become a classic.
Someone pointed out something really interesting to me that as someone who really hasn't played D&D for 30 years, and it's not for lack of interest. I just don't know that many people who do it. There's an element of that film that is actually kind of meta, where if you were like watching people play that campaign, like those are like, there are people like at a table rolling dice for like, Michelle Rodriguez is going to like do a cool bow and arrow thing and snaps the back of someone's head. Okay. Well, roll
then, for initiative.
Exactly. Yeah. There are multiple elements of that movie that's the campaign going wrong, and like,
well, there's an NPC character.
Yeah.
There's that handsome helper character who just sort of appears out of nowhere.
Just to get them out of
back
the jam.
On the right track.
Yeah. Then that happens a couple of times.
And then he vanishes out of the movie.
Yeah, we come up with like a really clever thing, and then someone rolls a natural one, and then shit. Okay, well, we need to come up with a new plan. And I hadn't really thought of it along those lines, but yeah, that's in there. That's really clever, actually. Mm. So it's really fun. Yeah, I like that movie a lot. Someone recently turned me on to Dimension 20, which is a series of... there's a lot of like web shows that are just people playing role-playing games. Mm. But the cool thing about Dimension 20 is... And I'm sure it's not alone in this, but it has a lot of like really experienced like ad-lib comics working on it. But it's also DM'd by Brennan Lee Mulligan, who takes it really fucking seriously and tries to weave complex narratives. And also, they'll, like, animate it and shit. Like, they're just, like... Yeah. I mean, that's not a super original, but, like, they just have a particular vibe. I like... I've been watching more of that, yeah.
All right. Move to the next email.
Let's do it.
This someone has no name, so name redacted.
Okay.
Greetings, gentlemen. This is about the movie Black Hawk Down.
Oh!
Okay. Greetings, gentlemen. Hope you're both doing well. I don't really have a question this time, but I wanted to acknowledge something you brought up on a podcast recently. During your view of the movie Warfare, you both brought up the trope that is commonly used in recent war movies, which is the idea that no man gets left behind. Specifically when talking about the movie Black Hawk Down, which is one of my favorite Ridley Scott movies.
Fair enough.
Growing up, I thought this idea was mostly a Hollywood movie cliche, but I started doing some cursory reading and found it is actually a motto/core value used in the armed forces.
True.
On the one hand, it helps build morale and cohesion amongst a unit, with the understanding that each person will be supported if they are injured or captured. And in the event someone is killed in battle, it is used to reflect their sacrifice and make sure they are recovered and properly laid to rest.
Yes.
I understand that it wasn't intended to be dismissive when discussing both films, that they just leave them behind. Most people would be fine, but if I did... but I did want to acknowledge that there is a reason why it's often a detail in these types of movies beyond simply a movie trope.
That's true. Is that the end of the email?
And that's the end of the email.
Okay. No, that's true. I apologize if we were being a little flippant about that. I actually come from a Marine Corps family. My dad was a Marine. My brother was a Marine. My grandfather was a Marine. And I have a lot of respect for people in the armed forces. I don't have a lot of respect for what politicians do with the armed forces and some of the missions they've been forced to be on. And of course, there are bad people in every place in the world. So I know there are crappy Marines out there. But generally speaking, I have a lot of respect for the armed forces. And that is a thing.
Yeah.
It is a natural tendency. And I think it's hard to shake ourselves of this sometimes. And we talk about this in horror movies a lot, where, like, if someone's, like,
suffering and dying, and we just sort of laugh at it.
Not that. I guess that, too, but that's not what I was thinking about. Just, we are watching from the safety of a movie theater, and we only have so much emotional connection to the people in the film. The more emotional connection, the more... when Ripley goes back to save the cat at the end of Alien... Mm-hmm. We want her to save that cat. She's lost everything. This means a lot to her to save one life.
We also acknowledge that it's a fiction. There's going to be a little bit of distance no matter how great the movie
is. That's true, but it's easy for us to judge characters based on criteria that the characters themselves do not feel. So this is important to the character. And maybe there are movies in which that could be more adequately conveyed to the audience so that we feel it too, even if we don't have similar experiences, if we don't have similar values or viewpoints. But yeah, it's easy to sit in a movie theater and go, well, just don't do that. Mm-hmm. But to those characters, it's not really an option because of their ethos. So I apologize if we were flippant, actually. That's a fair critique. I think it's a fair point.
Yeah.
Because if nothing else, Black Hawk Down sells that that's important to them.
Well, it's important to them, but, you know, as a cynical dude who's just in a movie theater, it's like, leave no man behind. Well, leave one behind and everybody leaves. It's fine. Just, that guy can die.
Yeah, no, that's your, that's a different value set, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, like, to the characters in the movie, it matters.
Yeah.
And arguably, you know, I'm not sure they're not the only ones to whom that matters, you know, but, yeah, there is always a bit of distance between you and the movie, but the movie is trying to generate as much empathy as possible. Mm. And if the movie is doing its job, it should get you there.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a critique of Black Hawk Down, at least from Whitney. I used to love that movie, and I still admire it. I think it's a masterpiece of editing. Mm. But there are certainly, as a political document, there are things that I take issue with that are now make it a less fun watch.
Well, it goes to a larger issue with the relationship between cinema and war, eventually. Yeah. Ridley Scott is trying to tell this very empathetic story about the soldier's experience, but he is making a piece of art. He's choosing to make this film about those people in this particular era in history.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a politic to the film outside of whatever was going on with those soldiers' experiences.
I'd say he doesn't have to make it, but I actually don't know the specifics of that, because sometimes people do have to make
it. Well, they're under contract or something.
I was just, I just introduced Jaws at the Egyptian Movie Theater, which was a lot of fun. Thank you to everyone who came out. I didn't really get a chance to see anybody. A couple people texted me.
Finally saw Jaws.
Yeah, it's true. What was I doing? But, like, one of the things when I was, like, putting together my presentation, and I talked about how nearly impossible it was for Jaws to get made. Like, it's a movie that practically didn't want to get made. Like, it's just...
it was, like, production problems. It went... Funding problems.
It went 300% over schedule. It went 200% over budget. And right before they shot it, Steven Spielberg was like, I want out. I just did a killer truck movie. Now I'm going to do a killer shark movie. I don't want to be that guy. And then Universal's like, you're under contract, so fuck you. So that was the end of that conversation. Yeah. The only reason Jaws exists at all was Spielberg didn't want to make it, but he had to. Regardless, she chose to make it that way, if nothing else. Mm. And those are all decisions that I guess resonated with Ridley Scott.
I felt sorry for the shark in Jaws.
The shark? This is part of my presentation. The shark is just a shark. The
shark's just an animal. It's just doing its thing. It's like
it eats. That's what it does.
But the characters all treat it like it's this horrible monster, and they're like shoving dynamite in its mouth. So just leave it alone. It'll swim away.
Well, because that's the whole thing, is if everyone had just not swum in that ocean for a while, it would have not had enough food, and it would have left.
Yeah.
And that is the point of the movie, to be fair. Well, we made this its feeding grounds, and therefore now it is our natural predator, and we need to get rid of it.
I didn't realize until I finally sat, because I had seen all of Jaws, just never in order. I'd seen, like, bits and pieces of it throughout and sort of assembled it in my head, but I never watched it from beginning to end until, like, just, like, last month. And I didn't realize how much of that film is devoted to the boat sequence.
Oh, yeah, it's like the third act.
It's the entire third of that movie is just them swimming around trying to find the shark and blow it up. It's or just go home. It's the same, you know, the Black Hawk Down principle. Leave, the shark will swim away, you're fine. We don't need all of this stuff.
I contend that there were probably other ways to handle that shark, but... Yeah. That's not really what the movie is about.
It's not Godzilla.
Well, even Godzilla actually had a motive sometimes.
Yeah.
In certain Godzilla movies, he actually is like, I am the spirit of ghosts who died in World War II, and I will have my revenge.
Yeah.
And it's like, so that one, yeah, okay, fine. We got to fight that one off. That's not good. You know, that guy's got it in for
Godzilla's
us.
Godzilla's like Godzilla intelligence. You want to fight Godzilla. The shark's just a shark.
Yeah.
And, you know, we finally see it, and it's like this big, you know, rubber appliance. So it's like, it's not expressive. It doesn't...
Well, that's the thing. And I like that it's not expressive, because it's a shark. Yeah. It's a dead-eyed thresher with gills.
But the point is, we can't project a lot of personality onto the shark other than what the people say. Oh, this shark will swallow you whole. It's this monster.
But then we see it,
and it's just a fish.
What I think is interesting is that in Jaws 3 and 4, they actually do try to give the shark some personality, because in 4, they accidentally killed one of its babies.
That's right.
So it's going after him like, you know, mother, like a lioness. And then in Jaws the Revenge, that particular Jaws is going after that family.
Yeah.
And the original storyline, as is my understanding, was there was supposed to be a voodoo curse involved. And they cut that out, probably for the best, but they still left in the shark's, like, motivation that only makes sense if you bring in a voodoo curse. And I was just, in my last thing before we move on, in my intro, I said, but what do I know? I'm the only critic who likes Jaws the Revenge. And I said, if you can find me, I will explain why. And someone did, actually, like, one of the ushers, like, stopped me. And he was
what the hell are you talking
about? No, seriously, it was a fair point. I was like, well, here's the thing. Jaws the Revenge is actually a pretty lousy killer shark movie. But as a movie about how nobody listens to middle-aged women and takes them seriously, it's actually quite good.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
And so if you look at it as a character piece for Lorraine Gary, it's actually a solid film and she's doing remarkable work in it. So I actually like that movie a lot. It's just not a good Jaws movie. It is its own thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Here's our next letter. This one comes from Josh. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, in a recent episode, you brought up the great Yahoo Sirius.
Yay!
And as an Australian who has seen the sign Yahoo Sirius Festival and understands the words and the sign, therefore makes perfect sense, I thought it would be worth a quick email about the weird history of Yahoo Sirius and Australian film.
Yay!
I explained what I imagine is about to be laid out.
I hope so.
For context, Yahoo Sirius wrote, directed, produced, and starred in three films.
Hmm.
Young Einstein, 1988.
Classic.
Reckless Kelly, 1993. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Accident, 2000.
Never saw Mr. Accident.
Yeah. All of these films are very Australian, heavily referencing the culture of the time. As a kid, Young Einstein was one of those VHS tapes that somehow ended up in our house, and I watched it over and over. My dad took me to see Young Einstein.
I saw that constantly on TV because what happens is it's like they take Einstein's bio and they transpose it into not just Australia, but also to ways that like kids could understand.
Mm.
So like, you know, it's like the idea that light travels in particles and waves, he equates to rock and roll. So Einstein also invents rock and roll on the electric guitar.
Mm.
And it's like, yeah, that's ridiculous. But also when they just explain it, I mean, kinda. Like, you can wrap your head around the premise if you get the metaphor, you know?
And he learns how to, like, split particles, but he does it with, like, a chisel.
Yeah. And his motive is to put bubbles into
beer. Like, somehow if you split beer atoms, you can carbonate beer.
And he's so proud. He shows his dad his equation, and his dad says, Emk!
Yeah, E equals MC squared. That's, yeah.
Emk. Classic.
It's been a second since I've seen it. I remember enjoying
it when I was 10 years old. It's a very silly and weird film.
Anyway,
I like that he saved the pie full of cats. It's very important. Because I was very worried about those cats, and then he rescues them.
He's committed to an asylum, and it's so horrible, they, like, serve live kittens in pie. And the chef, like, puts the pie shell over it, and puts the live kittens in the oven.
Yeah.
And they save the kittens.
Yeah, like split second later, Einstein saves the kitten. Yeah. So we're okay.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Anyway, looking back, it's a weird film. For those who haven't seen it, it's all weird magnificence. It's a period piece where Yahoo Sirius plays Albert Einstein. It loosely follows a few real life points, but changes almost everything else.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, Einstein is from Tasmania, the island off the bottom of Australia, and grows up on his family's apple orchard. The plot kicks off when he figures out how to put bubbles in beer by splitting beer atoms. Then he heads to the mainland to work on a patent office to try to get his invention off the ground. The film only gets weirder from there. He ends up inventing rock and roll and surfing, gets committed to a mental hospital, and for mad scientist, and romances Marie Curie.
Oh my god, I forgot about that part. Yeah, see, that's a little apocryphal.
A little.
I think it was mostly a fling for them in real life. But yeah, in this one, they're true love. Yeah.
In a second feature, Reckless Kelly, in which he plays a descendant of Ned Kelly, who moves to L.A. to make movies and is actually quite significant in Australian film history. That significance has little to do with the bonkers plot and everything to do with its funding. The film was partially funded by the Australian government, which led to a major controversy and sparked national debates about public arts funding. Because the film was such an oddball comedy with blockbuster ambitions, many critics and politicians argued that it wasn't a serious artistic work and therefore was a waste of taxpayer money. The backlash intensified when the film underperformed at the box office. Mm. The controversy became so notable that it is now used as a case study in high school film classes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And this is something that I think Americans aren't always aware of. A lot of other countries, like their governments...
publicly fund their feature films.
Like, filmmakers go to the government and say, like, we'd like to make a movie, and the government would actually sponsor that movie. But the idea is, in most countries anyway, we're going to sponsor that movie if it has some sort of cultural value to it.
Yeah, some sort of patriotic message.
Well, it doesn't have to be patriotic. It just has to be, you know, they have to deem it not just a lark.
Yeah.
There has to be, like, a reason for this movie to exist beyond just it would be neat. So.
His third film, Mr. Accident, was intended to be his triumphant comeback, but it also underperformed and ultimately became his last film, which is a shame because they are all strange and wildly ambitious. And a bit of fun trivia, in 2000, he famously tried to sue the Yahoo website for copyright infringement.
Good for him!
The case was dismissed.
Damn it.
More recently, Yahoo Sirius has faced financial difficulties and has been back in the news over the past few weeks after being accused of squatting in a house on Sydney's northern beaches.
Oh, that's too
bad. Things turn around for him. Anyway, thanks for all you do. Cheers, fellas. Josh.
Yeah, I didn't know that about Yahoo Sirius. That's too bad. I always liked Yahoo Sirius. Thought he was a funny, clever guy. Like, I don't know anything about him personally, but I always enjoyed his films, and even, like, the not good... Like, Reckless Kelly is not a particularly good film, but it's an unapologetically odd film, and I respect that.
Yeah, I think maybe I need to go back and see those. They're probably the kind of strange that I would appreciate even more as an adult.
I think Young Einstein is... probably holds up pretty good.
I know
I
that
seen it in a while, though.
Because his name was Yahoo Sirius, and because he came sort of at the... tail end of this brief flash of Australian influx that was coming into the United States at the time, he's considered a bit of a punchline. Specifically, like Crocodile Dundee was really huge.
Right. I think that's a little... I don't know if I entirely agree with that, because I think Australian independent cinema was still, like, pretty prominent throughout the 90s. We got a lot of memorable imports, like The Castle, Muriel's Wedding.
That was
a little later. My point is that it didn't really go away. But there was definitely a spike in interest, thanks largely to Crocodile Dundee, to be fair. Crocodile Dundee, people forget this, Crocodile Dundee was a monster. It was one of the biggest hits of the year.
It
was Oscar nominated for its screenplay.
Yeah.
And even the first sequel, Crocodile Dundee 2, which is not a good movie, it also made a ton of money. Like, it was huge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm looking up Crocodile Dundee. It had a budget of $8.8 million Australian dollars. Mm-hmm. It made $328 million U.S. dollars.
That's pretty damn good.
That was in 1986.
That's
dollars.
Huge.
$386 million.
$328 million. That's insane.
That's respectable for, like, superhero movies these days.
Hold on, I'm actually gonna look this up on one of those, like, inflation adjusters.
Or, like, how much that is in 2025 dollars.
Hold on a second.
Yeah, $328 million U.S. dollars.
Mm. So what was the year again?
86.
1986. Okay. 328.
And I saw it multiple times in theaters when I was a kid. Like, it was just everywhere. Everybody loved that thing.
That's almost $1 billion.
Yeah.
That's $960 million.
That's how big it was.
Like, that did as well or better than Oppenheimer. Like, that was a fucking big deal.
Hmm.
The zeitgeist, my friends. So yeah.
I think that, and Paul Hogan, they tried to make Paul Hogan into a bigger star. They tried putting him in another movie. He was the actor who played Crocodile Dundee.
He never quite had another big hit. I liked his movie Almost an Angel, where he played a bank robber who died while robbing a bank, and, like, the God basically says, you can't get into heaven. You haven't done anything. You've been a jerk this whole time. You've done all these crimes. And so he's like, he comes back to life, and he's now determined to do good deeds, but he only knows how to do bad things, so he tries to do them that way. And it's actually pretty good. It's not amazing, but it's pretty good. And then there was Lightning Jack with him and Cuba Gooding Jr., which is really terrible.
It's not great.
It's really bad.
I feel like they're trying so hard to make that script work. Lightning Jack.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm amazed that someone besides me remembers Lightning Jack.
I saw Lightning Jack.
I saw it in theaters.
I saw it on home video.
Oh, I saw it in theaters.
Rented from 2020 Video on Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica, California.
So,
Yahoo Sirius, though, like, he was seen as sort of like something that broke off of Paul Hogan at the time. Like, he was like, because it wasn't just Crocodile Dundee. Like, if you remember, there was, like, Australian beers and food products started to become more heavily advertised.
Yeah.
Paul Hogan was a spokesman for some of these things.
Sure.
There was this sort of, like, miniature explosion of Australian culture that made its way to the United States.
What were those treats? They were, like, little sugar crackers, and they, like, had a chocolate dip, but they looked like kangaroos?
Dunkaroos.
There you go.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think Tasmania, the cartoon series, was a little later.
It was a little later. I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of the pitch, though.
Yeah.
You know, people love Australian stuff. Tasmania was a good show, by the way. Tasmania was a surprisingly entertaining program. Anyway, we should
Anyway, here's another letter. This one comes from Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. Oh, that's me. First of all, I wanted to say thank you for the endless hours of entertainment that you provide. I've been getting more and more into film and cinema over the last few years, and the two of you are one of the main reasons why.
Oh, my God. Thank you. It's such an honor.
I originally discovered Critically Acclaimed with your series Episode Zero.
Oh, wow.
Which was referred to me by a friend. I loved hearing about the inspirations that George Lucas took from the films that were special to him and how those certain movies helped change history. That being said, as I continue to grow my love of cinema, I'm beginning to build out my physical collection. A lot of the movies I have purchased come from the collection such as Criterion and Kino Lorber. Mm-hmm. Do you have recommendations for carefully curated boutique collections that aren't as widely known? Thank you again for all that you do. Best, Matt H.
Okay.
Well, Umbrella. they've hired us to do some work for them.
We've done a little work for Umbrella. If you get the special edition of the Umbrella special edition of The Fall, Tarzan Sings The Fall, you'll get an essay from me. There's an upcoming Michael Haneke box set from Umbrella that includes essays from me and Whitney and commentary tracks from me and Whitney.
That's right.
So we're a little biased there. I've also done a little work for Arrow of late. You'll find my essays in films like FX. I think Cobra isn't out yet, but that's coming up.
Okay.
And others as well. Umbrella's a little less known, but I think Arrow is pretty famous. I think people appreciate what Arrow is doing. I am a huge fan of Vinegar Syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
I highly recommend Vinegar Syndrome. They do get legit films over there, but they're exceptionally good at finding worthwhile scuzz.
Like, what I love about Vinegar Syndrome, and in fact a lot of the boutique outlets I'm very fond of, is they find, like, the worst shit that you remember getting from a video store in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Some zero-budget, straight-to-video schlock. And brushing it up and giving it the same kind of polish that the Criterion Collection might give to, like, a Robert Bresson movie.
Well, because a lot of those early VHS copies, they're so degraded, and then there was no interest, so they were never, like, updated, or they were barely released on DVD with a not much better transfer. And, I mean, kudos to people like Vinegar Syndrome, because some of those movies look good.
Yeah.
You just never know it because of their previous releases. So I appreciate that they believe that every movie deserves a good transfer. But also, they do pretty carefully curate their stuff. I think Vinegar Syndrome is one of those companies where I don't have enough money to buy them all. But if I saw, like, oh, here's a Vinegar Syndrome copy of something, that's probably worth watching.
Yeah.
It might not be good by a classical definition, but it's probably interesting, weird, got some bizarre, cultural cachet I could never possibly imagine.
Yeah.
I've discovered a lot of interesting, Z-grade movies that deserve to be seen through Vinegar Syndrome. Also, they do a lot of porn, like 70s porn.
Yeah, like proper adult features.
Yeah, back when they had, a little bit more effort that went into the storytelling.
Uh-huh.
They're not all good, but it's interesting to see that era of filmmaking get a little respect from a distributor. So that's another good one.
Well, and not just Vinegar Syndrome, if you're familiar with Severin Films, they do something really similar. What was I just thinking of?
I don't know.
Arrow, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin. AGFA. The AGFA home video.
I don't know if I know AGFA.
The American Genre Film Association.
That's not ringing a bell off the top of my head. Have they released anything?
Or Genre Film Archive, excuse me. They do like a lot of sort of bizarre outsider kind of just like cult movies. If you go, AGFA put out a Doris Wishman box set, for instance.
Oh, I have that. That is an amazing. Amazing.
That's from AGFA.
I just didn't put that together. Anyone who puts out Doris Wishman movies is okay by me. That is one of the great auteurs who doesn't get any respect.
I'm also fond of Indicator. You might have seen some of their stuff.
I've seen some of their stuff.
Indicator, you'd recognize them because they have like a rainbow stripe across all of the fronts of their boxes, and they also find some really strange. Some are really, like, strange obscurities, but some are, like, what better known. They did put out an edition of, like, Night of the Demon, for instance. Mm-hmm.
They put out Injustice for All.
Yeah. Columbia horror films from the 40s. They got to put out a lot of, like, box sets.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely check out some Indicator. What else is
there?
Oh,
hold on. Dead Air. Dead Air. Everyone loves Dead Air. Let's do it.
Dead Air? Oh. I thought you just found a film called Dead Air.
We're literally just stopping here and thinking.
Yeah, just trying to think. Yeah, Indicator put out a Santo box set that I've got my eyes on, but I can't really afford to get it right now. What else? Who put out that Yorg Bukhar? Oh, that was Arrow.
Arrow
put out a Yorg Bukharite box set.
And kudos to them. Flickr Alley. That's one that I was trying to think of.
Flickr Alley. Is that the label?
It's a label. They do a lot of like silent movies and hard to find international movies. I do have, what do you say? I do know someone who works there, Silas Lesnick.
Oh, okay.
Who used to co-host a YouTube series with me. Currently works there and does like some of their material. But they do put out really interesting stuff. So if you're looking to, you know, spike your collection with interesting, you know, sort of talking points and such, they've got a lot. They've also got, Laurel and Hardy movies, Chaplin movies, but also like just stuff you never heard of. Oh, they put out The Plastic Dome of Norma Jean.
Oh, okay.
Which is one of the best movies no one's ever seen. I think it was Julian Compton. It's about a woman who is exploited in like a traveling show inside a giant plastic dome because she's allegedly psychic. Mm-hmm. And well, things go in a very tragic Tennessee Williams-ish kind of way. But I think it's also Sam Waterston's first movie.
Okay.
And he plays like a rock musician.
Sam Waterston has a huge filmography.
He does.
We know him as the Law and Order guy, but
he's been in everything for forever.
Much,
yeah, yeah. No, just but seriously, if you've never seen The Plastic Dome of Norma Jean, I cannot recommend it enough. It is an incredible motion picture that used to be completely unavailable, but is now available from Flickr Alley. So kudos to them for that.
So I hope that helps. Hopefully, look up some of their catalog. We don't want to go through their catalogs here. I just take up
no,
too
that'd just
much time,
be listing but, movies. Yeah. We've already done enough of that. yeah, hopefully it helps a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let's move on.
Here's a letter from Danny. Hello, Danny. Hello there, lads. Hope you're both well. Recently, I've been reading up on Richard Linklater's new film, Nouvelle Vague. That one's not out yet. And seeing it described as, quote, a love letter to cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking, are there any films that could be considered a hate letter to cinema? Thanks for reading. All the best, Danny.
That's a fun one.
Can't think of any off the top of my head, but they're probably made by Jean-Luc Godard. Godard was so fond of cinema, he had to kill it. His films are about like confronting the way cinema is made and trying to explode it all.
I can think of a few that are particularly, at the very least, hateful about the way movies are made.
Yeah, really cynical about
it. For one of my favorite movies about making movies is The Stuntman. Starring Steve Railsback, Peter O'Toole, Barbara Hershey, about a escaped felon who accidentally wanders into a stunt shot, gets a stuntman killed, and Peter O'Toole says, okay, well, I can't let this derail my production, so you're my new stuntman.
And I'm going to torture you.
Yeah, he's gonna completely abuse this guy, and it is fascinating and pretty on the money, actually, and Peter O'Toole gives one of his best performances, which is saying something. So that's a really good spiteful one. A movie which is kind of hard to watch now because of the Kevin Spacey of it all, but Swimming with Sharks is a hate letter to Hollywood, at least.
You know what? It might have actually strengthened that movie.
Maybe.
That's such a hateful guy in the middle of
no,
it.
No, that
because he plays such a horrible character.
Yeah, Frank Whaley plays a guy who, like, a young... he wants to be, like, an important artiste.
Film producer.
And the way to get there is you work your way up from crap jobs. And
he has to be the assistant to, like, the worst producer in Hollywood. He's played by Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, and there's literally a bit where, like, he's just sitting at his desk and Kevin Spacey throws something at him and he just goes, you're happy! I hate that!
Yeah.
And that's actually based on true shit.
Yeah.
That's actually not that far off, so that's a hate letter.
You pick it up and it's like, it's got, you know, the white video box and it's supposed to, and they say, oh, it's hilarious! It's like this, there is nothing funny about that movie.
It's pretty damn bleak.
It's sadistic film.
Yeah.
And you could say the same thing about Robert Altman's The Player, just, you know, filmmaking is just this completely corrupt enterprise that needs to be overseen by the worst possible people who have no morals and get away with everything.
You're not wrong. Yeah, that's about right.
I'm trying to think of something that just sort of hates cinema itself.
I mean, it's hypocritical if you're making a movie about it. It's to be fair,
but that's fine. That's
I'm not saying. I'm just saying I don't. That's why I think you can do that with art.
I think that's fine.
I'm just saying that's why I don't think there are all that many. But
We were just talking about Michael Haneke. He's sort of
Funny Games.
He confronts audiences about the way film is used and kind of almost deliberately. Gives you an irresponsible message so you can feel bad about the way cinema's manipulates you in that way. Yeah. But that's more implicating the audience than it is, but it is sort of making you feel bad for having a relationship with cinema.
I got it. The blank movies. Epic movie. Super. I mean, some of them are better than others, to be fair.
The Friedberg Seltzer spoof films from the mid-2000s.
Some of them are funnier than others. I've heard some people defend superhero movie. I will actually defend Date Movie. I actually think that one's pretty funny throughout and actually kind of works as a broad farcical rom-com. But the majority of those movies are so deeply cynical about what cinema is, just by their construct.
They're just these commercial images that sort of float by your eyes without context.
Without any effort, really. It's not like we're Amazon Women on the Moon, where like we're gonna put some we're really gonna tell that there's a great joke in Amazon Women on the Moon, if you've never seen it, is a sketch comedy movie that is intended to much like what's the one from the 70s? A Kentucky Fried Movie. Kentucky Fried Movie, it's kinda supposed to emulate what it's like to just watch random shit on TV super late at night and like flip through the channels. But there's this great bit with Robert Stack where he's like giving like a true crime show and it's like, yes, did Jack the Ripper kill this many people in 1890? I don't remember that off the top of my head. And but who was he? There are some who believe he was the Loch Ness Monster. And then they, like, recreate one of the murders, but, like, it's the Loch Ness Monster in, like, a top hat and a cape, and he's, like, 50 feet tall.
Stalking sex workers as this monster.
But, like, they put the effort in on that. Like, to not just do the joke, but sell the joke. And so many of those movies are just, like, we don't care about movies. We're just putting shit on a screen and hoping you giggle at it. Because movies is worth a lot of them.
I've seen a couple of those things. I haven't like really delved in because they're terrible. I've seen mostly the scary movie sequels.
I feel like the scary movies, especially the first couple, the Keenan Ivory Wayans ones, had a little bit more ambition to be commentary.
Yeah. On the way, like, the post-scream wave of slashers. So we're kind of commenting on
that. Too mixed effect, but I do believe that they're more ambitious than some of the later ones. And Not Another Teen Movie is pretty spot on, actually.
I feel like the function of those movies, though, seems to be a hate letter to the audience. And maybe the filmmakers as well. But I guess so. The idea
people
that
see movies.
It reduces, because that it doesn't put in any kind of effort and doesn't tell a joke with its references. It just has a reference. And the function of that, of course, is for you to get a little bit of thrill out of recognition. And there can be something to that. You recognize something and it's like, oh, yeah, that.
Well, I mean, that's a lot of Quentin Tarantino's career, isn't it? But he's good at masking it so that if you don't get the reference, you still think it's neat.
Well, it still functions as like something in the film. And if you do get the reference, or it seems kind of weird, it at least has like a little bit of style or panache to it.
You also get to pat yourself on the back. Like, oh yeah, I'm one of the people here who's seen Lady Snowblood. This is awesome.
I recognize the theme from Twisted Nerve, that kind of stuff. Yeah. What these movies kind of point out is that a lot of people aren't engaging with cinema in any kind of meaningful way. They're absorbing images and not giving any sort of thought to it. So if the audience isn't doing that, the filmmakers aren't going to either.
Yeah, so we're not going to bother because you don't care.
We don't care. You don't care. A film is nothing more than a string of recognizable images with no feelings or meaning behind it. Okay. They're reducing it to like a series of moving parts. It's like they're looking at a person and seeing nothing but pulsing organs rather than a collect. It's nothing more than a sum of its images.
Whitney, you're selling me on these movies. you're literally selling me on these movies as some kind of experimental, pure form of abstraction of what cinema is.
It's reducing pop culture to its just visual abstractions. That's all they're doing. Yeah.
I almost respect that now. Like, no, I'm dead serious. I'm literally rethinking my entire take on these movies.
It would be respectful if that's what they were trying to do, if there was kind of a Godardian underpinning to that. But these,
I think Friedberg, intentionality is only goes so far. So, you know, so, yeah, if it is what it is.
Friedberg and Seltzer aren't doing what Godard was trying to do, but they're the result is kind of the same after a while.
If anyone is putting any of those movies out on like a 4K Blu-ray or something like that, talk to us. Because apparently we have some shit to figure out. We will do the essay. We will do the commentary track. We will do it for real. All right. Moving on.
Hey, that's what's been going on with those.
Yeah.
Anyway, here is a letter from Blair. Hello, Blair.
Hi, Blair.
Greetings, fellow film buffs. Blair from Regina again. You know, the city that rhymes with fun. Well, maybe I should say Regina.
A lot of it was your delivery, to be fair, but
I was recently watching random Oscar-winning moments for Best Pictures on YouTube the other day, and I think I came up with is a rather interesting question I would like both of you to answer.
Okay.
The year is 2002.
Mm.
You are the only members of the Oscar committee, and you need to come up with your top five films that would be put in contention for Best Picture that year. Okay, I'm going to have to start looking
at
stuff
up here. Okay, but wait, is this the Oscar ceremony that was held in 2002, or are these for the movies from 2002?
These are movies from 2001.
Okay.
So the Oscar ceremony from 2002.
That's the wonky thing with
it. Okay. Not only do I want you to list your top five, I need you to pick a winner from each other's list. Bibbs, you will pick a winner from Whitney's list, and vice versa. Just to refresh your memories, here are the five nominees from that year.
Okay.
A Beautiful Mind, Gosford Park, In the Bedroom, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, and Moulin Rouge.
Okay.
Hope you're finding peace in your days. Now, In the Bedroom was one of the best films that year.
That's an excellent movie.
I would keep In the Bedroom.
I think there's a definite argument for that.
I love Gosford Park.
Okay.
Beautiful Mind is Hollywood.
It's Hollywood trash. Yeah. It's the kind of trash that is, like, it looks like great cinema because it's acting like great cinema, but it's actually just a big old collection of shameless and frankly insincere cliches.
There's a lot of cliches in there.
Yeah, so I'm not fond of it. I would actually, honestly, like, I think there is a great argument to be made, and you're going to fight me on this, for Lord of the Rings and Moulin Rouge to be in there. Because I know you find...
I dislike both of those movies.
I know you dislike both of those movies. I do think both of them are pushing what cinema can do, at least at the time. One in terms of what epic filmmaking can be, and another in terms of just how outlandish cinema can be. And I respect both of those movies for that, and I'm a bigger fan than you are, so I think I'm probably going to keep both of those films. I am actually going to do something we never do. I'm going to pause this for a second so that we can take a good gander at the films of 2002 rather than
2001.
I'm sorry, 2001. And then we will get back to you in a minute, okay? So I'm going to hit pause here and we'll be back. For you, it will be a second. For us, it'll probably be a few minutes.
All right, give me a pen and paper.
Hang on. And we are back, and we've got our five. So Whitney has his five, I have mine. We've not talked about it. Do you want me to go first, or should you go first?
These were hastily assembled.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's something we're forgetting.
We didn't get a chance to really kind of deeply delve.
Yeah, allowing for some really cool, probably international features that didn't necessarily spring to mind. But, and maybe some documentaries, I don't know. But I do have my five.
All right.
Do you want to go first, or should I?
I'll go first.
Okay, alphabetical order, like the Oscars.
Oh, alphabetical, all right. So I guess alphabetically, my first would be Ghost World.
Okay.
Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World. Followed by The Piano Teacher.
Okay.
The Michael Haneke movie.
Of course.
Followed by Spirited Away.
Hayao Miyazaki's shit, was that that
animated
year?
Animated film. It came out in the United States that year, yep.
Is that when it was... That wasn't when it was nominated for animated feature, though, right?
I think it was. It was 2002. I think it was the 2002 Oscars.
Let me make sure it was eligible then. Right. I just want to make sure. Spirited Away.
If not, I got runners up.
Best animated feature. No, that was later. That was it was in America. It won in 2003.
Oh, so
it would have been a 2002 release in America.
No, fine. Okay,
sorry, not just not eligible. We're doing the
not
Oscars.
Not Spirited Away.
It's a great pick.
It's a great pick,
but it wasn't that year.
In that case, moving along. What do I want to replace that one with?
It's okay if it messes up the alphabet.
Okay. In that case, I'm going to choose David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Okay.
So yeah, Ghost World, Mulholland Drive, Piano Teacher, Waking Life.
Ah, great pick.
And Werkmeister Harmonies.
Those are my five. Yes, the Oscars would have loved Werkmeister Harmonies. I'm just saying.
Oscars are no gauge of, like, actual quality.
No. We all know it. Okay, so, well, I'm going to seem very basic compared to that. but I do love these movies, and I think they all deserve to be on here. So, my first pick, I recently rewatched this, and it was an Oscar nominee for not for Best Picture. I think it should have been. Bridget Jones's Diary. Rom-coms don't get much better, I'm not going to lie. Let's see here. My next up alphabetically would be Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. Followed by Moulin Rouge. We're going to leave that in too. Followed by Mulholland Drive. We both agree on that one.
All right.
And rounding it out, The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, well, a movie I'm very, very fond of and love.
I feel like that was still before Wes Anderson really hit his stride.
Sure,
like
sure.
The films got better after he made that one.
I think that was his first Oscar nomination, though, because he was nominated for screenplay for that, along with Owen Wilson, if memory serves. I think he co-wrote that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now
I have to pick one from your list.
You have to pick one from my list. So
let's swap lists here.
Okay, well, okay. There you go. So, yeah. Very, very official.
Bridget Jones. Oh, I mean, because I picked it, I would from your list, I'd choose Mulholland Drive.
Of course you would. Yeah. Well, I'm going to... I'm also going to pick Mulholland Drive because it's the one we agree on, but if that had to lose, what would be your number two pick?
Okay, Lord of the Rings, Moulin Rouge, Bridget Jones... I guess Royal Tenenbaums.
Okay, that's
Bridget Jones's Diary, I'm not going to assault Bridget Jones's Diary. It's a delightful film.
Yeah.
Lord of the Ring, Moulin Rouge is an assault. It is an ugly film. I do not enjoy watching it.
I like salt.
No,
it makes everything taste better.
A salt. It is.
Yes,
it's
some salt on that, yeah.
Not that films have to be subtle, but you can do better than that.
All right.
Baz Luhrmann.
All right. And he did, to be fair.
Yeah, he did Strictly Ballroom, and it's been downhill ever since then. No, anyway. I actually really like his Elvis as well.
Elvis is good.
I like Elvis.
All right, I'm gonna just move on. And I'm from your pick. If I'm not picking Mulholland Drive, it's Waking Life. Waking Life. These are films that are. I mean, Mulholland Drive was nominated for stuff, but Waking Life was never going to win Best Picture. But in our world, it would. I think that's a better.
I remember being really outraged though because that was the first year that the Academy introduced the Best Animated Feature category.
Yeah.
And they nominated three films.
It was Monsters, Inc., Shrek, and was it Jimmy Neutron?
And Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius.
Yeah.
It's like, there were so many better animated films that they could have just included.
Waking Life got robbed, man.
And Waking Life was one of them. Waking Life was made, it was super low budget. It was made on laptops by a bunch of different animators who were working on, like, sections of the film on their own. And it was all done with sort of rotoscope. So Richard Linklater filmed it, and then the animators animated over that and added a lot of expression and made it really dreamlike. And it's about dreams, so it made perfect sense. It's fantastic. It's a work of philosophy.
Yeah.
And, just didn't get any sort of awards attention because I think it was a little too odd.
It's very experimental. It's very formless, you know. But again, that's the point. I agree.
I've watched that film so many times in the early 2000s.
That movie passed the Billy Elliot test for me, where I was up for like 36 hours and then I put on Waking Life and it kept me up.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, there you go. Again, not advisable, the Billy Elliot test. I can't recommend it. Do not try this at home. But if a movie does happen to pass that test, you know it's a good one.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for writing in. Sorry if we didn't get to your email. We'll do some more later. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter if you like, or a postcard to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Do it today. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where you get to listen to all of our shows ad-free. Sometimes you get to listen to them early. We also have a lot of exclusive programming over there for our patrons. And even if you sign up for free, which we encourage you to do, you will get our weekly newsletter, which is full of updates about me and Whitney, writing you won't see anywhere else, and links to our various work throughout the week. Because we both write a lot. basically, that's it. So thank you, everybody, once again, for being awesome. We think you're awesome. We're on social media, Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
Yeah,
is that Whitney Seibel?
All the usual of that. Yeah.
Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.